Thank you, Brother Jeremy. Ask Brother Alan Clark then to step forward and to speak to us on the first parable of Balaam.
My dear brothers and sisters, the situation, as we saw this afternoon, of the first parable, the first prophecy of Balaam, is recorded in the 41st verse of Numbers chapter 22. It came to pass on the morrow that Balak took Balaam and brought him up unto the high places of Baal, that thence he might see the utmost part of the people. The high places of Baal in the Hebrew is Bamoth Baal. It's the plural, the word Bamoth is the plural of Bama. A high place was an elevated platform on which they would worship. In the land of Israel, there's a well-known one in the north of the land at Dan. It's probably the place where the golden calf was set up by Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, parallel with the one in Bethel further south. That was one high place. It was a centre of sin in Israel. Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. It was associated with idolatrous worship. And this was called Bamoth Baal, the high places of Baal. Not just one, but a multitude of them. This was indeed a system of iniquity that was being set up in order to destroy the people of Israel on this occasion. Balak took Balaam and brought him up to Bama Baal, that thence he might see the utmost part of the people. Now that doesn't mean that he could see the whole people. It means that he could see the edge, just the edge of the people. In verse 36, we read, "And when Balak heard that Balaam was come, he went out to meet him unto a city of Moab, which is in the border of Arnon, which is in the utmost coast," right on the edge. We can see the meaning of the word there. And in chapter 23 and verse 13, Balak said unto him, "Come, I pray thee, with me to another place from whence thou mayest see them. Thou shalt see but the utmost part of them, and shalt not see them all, and curse me them from thence." Clearly, Balak didn't want Balaam impressed by the wonderful encampment of Israel, the order of it. It was indeed a great blessing from their God to set the camp in order. They set the order of the march. They all had their instructions in the wilderness. They were the army of the living God. Another use of the same word to explain what it means is in Exodus chapter 36. In connection with the furniture of the tabernacle, or the coverings of the tabernacle, in Exodus chapter 36 and verse 12, we read, 50 loops made he in one curtain, and 50 loops made he in the edge of the curtain, which was in the coupling of the second. The loops held one curtain to another, and it was the edge of the curtain. That edge of the curtain is the same as the utmost part of the children of Israel. That's an interesting idea that Brother Lane put before us, that from that position, slightly to the or just parallel with the northern end of the Dead Sea, he will be looking towards Israel in a northwesterly direction, and the utmost part that he would see would probably be the western part of the camp of Israel, where the children of Judah and the children of Joseph and the children of Benjamin would be encamped. That's quite interesting in connection with other things that we shall read concerning this first prophecy, the first parable of Balaam. So in chapter 23 and verse 1 we read that Balaam said unto Balak, "Build me here 7 altars, and prepare me 7 oxen and 7 rams." Now here was a system of worship connected with the worship of the children of Israel. It wasn't unknown for bullocks and rams to be used as burnt offerings. Verse 3 says, "Stand by thy burnt offering." And in fact, the word "offered" in verse 2 is the offering of a burnt offering. So these bullocks and rams were to be, or seven oxen and seven rams, the word means bullocks. It's the same as bullocks in other parts of the law. These were to be offered as burnt offerings. Now, in the dedication of the tabernacle, in the preparation for the tabernacle to be the centre of worship of the people of Israel, there were bullocks and rams offered, but the bullock was for a sin offering and the rams were for a burnt offering. So there wasn't a direct parallel there with the worship of the children of Israel, although there was some similarity. In Numbers chapter 7, we have the dedication of the tribes of Israel and the heads of the tribes who offered a bullock, a ram, and a lamb each for a burnt offering. But those bullocks, rams, and lambs would all be offered on one altar. The worship of Yahweh was connected with one altar. There is only one centre of sacrifice in connection with the worship of the God of Israel. Here we have seven altars, a multitude of places of worship away from the way that God wants. One place where we do get seven bullocks and seven rams comes in a very interesting situation. Something that had happened before the time of Balaam, probably. And that's in the last chapter of Job. Job chapter 42. I find this a remarkable parallel of the worshipping or the offering of seven bullocks and seven rams. Job chapter 42 and verse 8. "Therefore take unto you now seven bullocks and seven rams," this is speaking to his three friends, "and go to my servant Job and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you, for him will I accept, lest I deal with you after your folly, in that ye have not spoken of me the thing which is right, like my servant Job." Now, the reason why they had to offer these offerings was that they had not spoken that which of Yahweh, that which is right, like my servant Job. Now, we see what's going to happen with Balaam, and this is anything but that which is right of the God of Israel. Again, the offerings would be upon one altar. But it may be that there was some recollection and some record of this offering that Balaam is trying to copy on this occasion in order to pacify the God of Israel and to get him to allow him to curse the people of Israel. But the spirit of a multitude of offerings is the way God regards the spirit of a multitude of offerings is given to us in the prophecy of Isaiah in chapter 1. And this, I think, very much characterises the seven bullocks and seven rams offered on this occasion. The prophecy of Isaiah, chapter 1, speaking of the way the children of Israel, although they were following the forms of worship of the law, they were not following in the right way. They weren't doing it with the right heart. Verse 11 of Isaiah chapter 1. "To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices unto me, saith Yahweh? I am full of the burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed beasts. I delight not in the blood of bullocks or of lambs or of he-goats. When ye come to appear before me, who hath required this at your hand to tread my courts? So God doesn't want it. Bring no more vain oblations, incense is an abomination unto me. The new moons and Sabbaths, the calling of assemblies, I cannot away with. It is iniquity, even the solemn meeting. All their worship was not acceptable because it wasn't being done in the right spirit. We need to understand that the burnt offering indicated the consuming of a whole life in the service of the God of Israel. That was the message of the burnt offering, a complete dedication of the life of the offerer to the service of the God of Israel. And what sort of dedication was involved with Balaam's sacrifice, or even Balak's? It was actually Balak that was offering the sacrifices. Balaam was telling him to do it. But certainly, this was not acceptable to the God of Israel. And so, verse 2 of Numbers chapter 23, Balak did as Balaam had spoken. And Balak and Balaam offered on every altar a bullock and a ram. Can you just imagine the situation here, all the ceremony that it involved, the build-up to this vision, this time of the cursing of this people that had come out of Egypt. The ceremonies, you can just see the counterpart in the ceremonies of the churches of the world, particularly at this time of the year. All their finery is on display. The whole of the people is brought together in a false worship. And verse 3 says, Balaam said unto Balak, stand by thy burnt offering, and I will go. Peradventure Yahweh will come to meet me, and whatsoever he showeth me, I will tell thee. And he went to an high place. And that wasn't a Abana, it was a Hebrew word which means bare or exposed. Something that is above the level of the surrounding area. Something that is barren. And he wanted to go there on his own to perform his incantations, to get himself in the mood, as it were, to be able to pronounce this curse upon the people of Israel. He wondered if Yahweh would come to meet him. He was hoping he wouldn't, because he wanted to curse. And God had told him already that this people was blessed. And so he may have been surprised when, verse 4, Elohim met Balaam. Quite interesting how the expressions are different on different occasions. Here we read in verse 4 that Elohim met Balaam. We go on later on in the chapter when he tries the next time. It says that, verse 16, and Yahweh met Balaam. Now presumably the angel of Yahweh that had stood in his place, in his way as he went with the men of Moab, was the one that is spoken of as Yahweh. But there were other angels involved in this. But just think again of the way that the God of Israel is working in this situation. The angels are performing his will to bring about his purpose. We've got Elohim here, another one that's spoken of as Yahweh on the next occasion. Well, verse 4 then says, Elohim met Balaam, and he said unto him, I have prepared 7 altars, and have offered upon every altar a bullock and a ram. But Yahweh doesn't accept those sacrifices. It says that Yahweh put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, return unto Balak, and thus thou shalt speak. No compromise. Yahweh doesn't change. It's only man that changes. Yahweh had his purpose, and Balaam was going to perform that purpose. Yahweh put a word in Balaam's mouth. And Balaam had seen an example of exactly that. When the word of Yahweh was put in the mouth of the ass, the dumb ass, speaking of the madness of the prophet, rebuking him. And so Yahweh put a word. And so the words that Balaam speaks are inspired words. These are the words of inspiration. They are the words of the Spirit. They are the words of Yahweh. And so verse 6 goes on to say, and he returned unto him, and he stood by his burnt sacrifice, he and all the princes of Moab. Again, just look at the finery that is here. The whole. It wasn't the lower echelons of the rulership of Moab. These were the top people, all in their finery, looking for this time. They paid good money. They were going to pay very good money for this curse of the people that had come out of Egypt. They hadn't mentioned them by name yet. And so, you've got that. You can just imagine the scene, can't you? These altars all around, with the smoking of the sacrifices, and then Balaam comes to these people standing by their burnt sacrifices. And verse 7 says, and he took up his parable and said, Balak the king of Moab hath brought me from Aram out of the mountains of the east, saying, come, curse me, Jacob, and come, defy Israel. He took up his parable. He spoke the words that Yahweh had put in his mouth. Balak, the king of Moab. It is he that was the prime mover on this occasion in bringing a curse upon the people of Israel. And so he's brought me all the way from Aram. Now we've already heard today that Aram covered a large area. It covered the whole of the Fertile Crescent, so that different parts are called by different names. We've heard of Padan Aram this afternoon, which was the area from which Balaam came. A bit further down the Euphrates Valley, near to where it joins the Tigris, there is an area between two rivers, and that is called Aram Naharaim, Aram of the two rivers. In Greek, it's called Mesopotamia, between the rivers. And we know that area. That was all part of Aram. And the way that the word Aram is usually translated in the scriptures is by the name Syria. And we know where Syria is. That's down to the west of the Fertile Crescent. So that whole area is the area of Aram. The particular area that he's come from, we know he brought him from Aram into this place to curse the people of Israel. And so we have the statement, he hath brought me from Aram out of the mountains of the east. Out of the mountains of the east. It's really from the north as far as Moab was concerned, I suppose. But he calls it the mountains of the east. The word translated east means before. It can mean before in time, and is sometimes translated ancient. It can mean before in the sense of in front of. Generally, geographical terms in the scriptures, in the Old Testament scriptures particularly, are from the standpoint of a person who looks east. That which is on the right hand is on the south. Sorry, to your right hand is on the south. And that which is on the left hand is the north. And that which is behind is the west. So that which is before is the east. So he calls it the mountains of the east. The only other place that I've found that Hebrew phrase translated mountains of the east is in Deuteronomy chapter 33 and verse 15. We have an interesting connection there with this utmost part of the camp of Israel. Deuteronomy chapter 33 and verse 15. It says, "For the chief things of the ancient mountains and for the precious things of the lasting hills." And the phrase translated ancient mountains is the same as mountains of the east in Numbers chapter 23. But just look at the context. We've been seeing that probably the utmost part that he saw was the children of Joseph and the children of Benjamin. Verse 12 says, "Of Benjamin," he said, this is Moses' blessing on the tribes of Israel just before they're going into the promised land. It couldn't have been more than a month or two after this, the events in Numbers chapter 23. "And of Benjamin," he said, "the beloved of Yahweh shall dwell in safety by him, and Yahweh shall cover him all the day long, and he shall dwell between his shoulders." And of Joseph, he said, "Blessed be Yahweh, blessed of Yahweh be his land, for the precious things of heaven, for the dew, and for the deep that coucheth beneath, and for the precious fruits brought forth by the sun, and the precious things brought forth by the moon, and the chief things of the ancient mountains, and for the precious things of the lasting hills, and for the precious things of the earth, and the fullness thereof, and for the goodwill of him that dwelt in the bush. Let the blessing come upon the head of Joseph, and upon the top of the head of him that was separated from his brethren." Just the utmost part of the camp he could see, and it's the part that is connected with him that was separated from his brethren. His glory is like the firstling of his bullock, and his horns are like the horns of unicorns. With them he shall push the people together to the ends of the earth. And they are the 10,000s of Ephraim, and they are the thousands of Manasseh. Now, that blessing of the tribes of Israel by Moses clearly has reference to the future. The chapter opens with a vision of the saints coming from Sinai, based clearly on the children of Israel coming from Sinai into the Holy Land. But they didn't come from Seir. They weren't allowed to go to Seir. The children of Edom wouldn't allow them to go there. So they had to go down by the way of the Red Sea and round the back in the barren wilderness to get, as we've seen this afternoon. And so the prophecy has to do with the future, when the saints will come from Mount Seir, from Sinai, and from Mount Seir, and from Mount Paran, and will go into the city of Jerusalem. And in connection with that time of blessing, we have the blessings of Joseph. Just consider what the rest of the scripture tells us about the precious fruits brought forth by the sun. Revelation chapter 16, "The kings of the east," the Greek says, "the kings of the risings of the sun." It's the resurrection of the saints and the glory that is going to be given to them. He's brought Balaam from the mountains of the east, part of the blessing upon the tribe of Joseph. What an ominous correction we have here then, brethren and sisters. If this man is trying to curse the people of Israel. Back in Numbers chapter 23 then, we read that he hath brought me from Aram out of the mountains of the east, saying, come, curse me, Jacob, come, defy Israel. Now I think probably most of you have a copy of this curse in the Old Testament. I just want to spend a bit of time on this so that we can see just how much variety there is in the words translated curse in the Old Testament. It's been remarked that the Hebrew language is very rich in names associated with the deity and in various other connections. Well, just look at the variety of words associated with cursing. The word, the main word for curse generally is the word arar. That's the number by the side there is the number in Strong's Concordance, if anybody wants to follow it through. The word arar means to curse, mostly as to its effect, but also to wish or speak evil of anyone. Another sense is to bind or immobilize. Probably the hope was that Israel would be immobilized so that the Moabites would be able to come and defeat them. Another sense is the state of lifelessness or the absence of blessing. That word is used 63 times, and 12 of those times it's used as the opposite of bless. It's the one that we normally think of when we think of scriptures associated with cursing. The first occurrence is Genesis chapter 3 and verse 14. Thou art cursed. And cursed is the ground, verse 17 of chapter 3. And chapter 5 and verse 29. And chapter 12 and verse 3 is interesting, because you've got two different words for cursing there. I will curse him, I will bless them that bless thee. What a contrast. Oh, brethren and sisters, look at the destiny of Abraham. I will bless them that bless thee, and I will curse him that curseth thee. And the curse is this word arar. As you see, the other part is the word kalau, which is the next word. Let's just stay with arar for the moment. You've got the water causing the curse in Numbers chapter 5 in the trial of jealousy. And then in connection with these chapters that we're looking at, it occurs in the 22nd chapter at verse 6 and at verse 12. In this verse 7, curse me Jacob. So Balak has said, curse me Jacob. And the same is said in chapter 24 and verse 9. Blessed is he that blesseth thee, and cursed is he that curseth thee. So, that's the one word for curse, and it's the most generally used word. Now, the word kalal isn't as strong as the word arar. It means to be light, of little account. To place lower in status, to speak of something that is noble as something as of no account. You can see how that comes to be translated as a curse. The first time that word is used is in Genesis chapter 8 and verse 8, when it speaks of the waters of the flood, that they were abated. Verse 21 of that chapter, God says that he will not again curse the ground. And chapter 12 and verse 3, the counterpart, God will curse him, arar, that curseth, kalau, thee. That doesn't give Abraham the honour to which he is entitled. I will curse him and bring evil upon him. Arar, that speaks of Abram in a lower way than his status requires. And so we've got that several times in the law. It's not used in these three chapters, chapters 22, 23 and 24, but it is used of this incident. If we go to Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 4, we've already seen it this afternoon. Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 4, the Ammonite or the Moabite shall not enter into the congregation, because they met you not with bread and with water in the way when you came forth out of Egypt, and because they hired against thee Balaam the son of Beor of Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse thee, to place on thee something that was lower than thy position deserved. And just think of that in relation to the people of Israel, all the sins that they had committed. One of the remarkable aspects of these prophecies of Balaam is the status of Israel compared with the people of Moab. Although they had sinned in so many ways and had gone astray continually through that wilderness journey, and a whole generation had been lost because of their sin, they still were noble in comparison with the Moabites. And Joshua chapter 24 and verse 9 also refers to the hiring of Balaam against the people of Israel. Joshua 24 and verse 9. Then Balak the son of Zippor, king of Moab, arose and warred against Israel, and sent and called Balaam the son of Beor to curse you. But I would not hearken unto Balaam. Therefore he blessed you still. So I delivered you out of his hand. I delivered you out of his hand. Here was the work of the God of Israel. It wasn't Israel, by their works of the law, that delivered themselves. It was Yahweh that delivered them out of his hand. Another word translated curse is the word Allah. The Strong's number is 423, which means a solemn oath and an execration. It doesn't occur in these chapters, but in Numbers chapter 5, it is an oath of cursing and to make thee a curse. That's one of the occasions where it is used. Another word is kabab, to pierce with words. A formula designed to undo. Here is the incantation type of thing that Balaam was trying to do. An utterance. And the only 8 times it occurs in the Old Testament scriptures is in these three chapters. In chapters 22, 23 and 24. In verse 8 of this chapter that we're looking at now. How shall I curse whom God hath not cursed? God hath not cursed is this word kabab, a formula designed to undo. God hasn't done it, so Balaam wasn't able to. The next word is nakab, to pierce, to perforate, to bore, to stigmatize, and it's a stronger sense than the word kalal, which was to treat of lower in status than it deserved. This was to pierce through. And there's an interesting occurrence of that in the Siloam inscription, which you may have heard of. Perhaps the Siloam inscription, perhaps we ought to explain what it is. You'll perhaps remember that Hezekiah was besieged by the Assyrians, and he dug a tunnel underneath the hill of Zion. So he brought the waters from the Gihon fountain inside the walls of the city and brought them out to the pool of Siloam. That was quite a feat of engineering in its day, and there was a Hebrew inscription placed at the time of Hezekiah in the tunnel, giving an account of the way the tunnel had been done. And in that inscription, this word nakab is used of piercing through, in the sense of digging the tunnel, going through the rock, the digging of the tunnel. So that's the sense of the word nakab. It was, at the time that it was found, the oldest Hebrew inscription that had ever been found. It's now in a museum in Istanbul. There's a copy in various other museums, including the British Museum and the Israel Museum. But in connection, the first time that it occurs is in Numbers chapter 3 and 23 and verse 8, this verse that we're coming on to now. How shall I curse whom Nakab, whom God hath not cursed, which was Kabab, that previous one. Another word that has the sense of curse, although isn't often translated curse, is the word Za'am, but that does occur in these chapters. It means to denounce, to curse, to be indignant. And it's the word translated defy in these verses. And just pick up the fact that that same word is used in Daniel chapter 8 and chapter 11, because we shall be looking at that a bit later on. So, we have this multitude of words, four of which are used in these chapters, and another one is used of the events in these chapters. Quite a variety of words for cursing. This was the whole object of the exercise, to bring a curse of any level upon the people of Israel. And they paid good money to do it. Right, verse 7 then, let's go back there. He took up his parable and said, Balak, the king of Moab, hath brought me from Aram, from the mountains of the east, saying, come, curse me, Jacob. Come, curse me, Jacob, and come, defy Israel. That's the word Za'am. How shall I curse whom God hath not cursed? How shall I curse Nakab, whom God hath not cursed, Kabab? And how shall I defy whom God hath not defied? And that's the word Za'am again. And so, if God has not cursed, then there is going to be no curse upon the people of Israel. That's really what is being said here. Verse 9. For from the top of the rocks I see him, and from the hills I behold him. Lo, the people shall dwell alone, and shall not be reckoned among the nations. From the top of the rocks, the word top is the word rosh, the word rocks is the word sur, the word sur is a rock, a boulder, which is in connection with humility. It's something that you can stand on. I see him from the hills, from the top of the rocks I see him, and from the hills I behold him. And the word translated hills is the word Gibeah. Now, that word Gibeah is used in Exodus chapter 17, which also brings out the sense of the word sur, the word rock, the top of the rock that is mentioned, the top of the rocks. In Deuteronomy, in Numbers chapter 23. Exodus chapter 17 is the record of the fighting between the children of Israel and the Amalekites. We've already had a reference to it this afternoon. But verse 9 says, And Moses said unto Joshua, Choose us out men, and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill, the Gibeah, with the rod of God in mine hand. So here is a great event in the history of Israel, a conflict with Amalek, and God on this occasion brings a great deliverance. Now, verse 6 says, Behold, I will stand before thee there upon the rock, the word Tsur, in Horeb. And thou shalt smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. They'd been without water, and Moses was told to take the elders of Israel and the rod that had been changed into a serpent. And all of this incident is associated with the crucifixion of Christ. I will stand thee on the rock. The rock was in a subdued position. It was to be smitten. And the elders of Israel joined with the Roman authorities as the seed of the serpent to bring about the crucifixion of the Messiah. And that was what was foreshadowed in the incident recorded earlier in Exodus chapter 17. So we've got the connection between the Gibeah and the Tsur in that chapter. In fact, the hills were there in Deuteronomy chapter 33 that we saw earlier. So that's another connection with this chapter, Numbers chapter 23. So, from the top of the rocks I see him, from the hills I behold him, below, the people shall dwell alone and shall not be reckoned among the nations. So they were not reckoned among the nations. In Leviticus chapter 26, we have a prophecy concerning the people of Israel. Numbers chapter 26 and verse 33. And I will scatter you among the nations. The Hebrew word is the same, the goyim. Leviticus 26 and verse 33. I will scatter you among the nations and will draw out a sword after you, and your land shall be desolate and your cities waste. So they were to be scattered among the nations. But then in Jeremiah chapter 31, we were only talking about Jeremiah 31 a bit earlier on, we have the statement that he that scattered Israel, the same word is in Leviticus chapter 26, will gather them. They were scattered among the nations. They're going to be gathered from among the nations, so they will be no longer among the nations. They will not be reckoned among the nations. Here is the future blessing of the people of Israel. They're going to be a nation alone. They shall dwell alone. And we've got the sense of them dwelling solitarily spoken of by Micah in chapter 7 and verse 14. So, verse 10. Who can count the dust of Jacob, or the number of the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous, and let my last end be like his. Who can count the dust of Jacob? Abraham was told in Genesis 13 and verse 16, his descendants would be as the dust of the earth. Jacob was also told in chapter 28 and verse 14 that his descendants would be as the dust of the earth. And if he was able to count the dust of the earth, so he would be able to count the number of his descendants. Who can count the dust of Jacob? Indeed, the natural descendants of Jacob are yet to be a multitude. But as in so many prophecies, we have a contrast, as in verse 7, come curse me Jacob and come defy Israel. Jacob, in prophecy, usually refers to Israel after the flesh. Israel, in prophecy, usually refers to Israel after the spirit. And if we have the fulfillment of the promises in the dust of Jacob, what have we in the numbering of the fourth part of Israel? perhaps that uttermost part of the camp was those three tribes who had one of the standards of Israel, which we believe would be the ox. It's one of the standards, the animal faces of the cherubim. And that represents a multitude which no man can number. And if you can't number the whole, you can't count the fourth part. And so we look forward to the time of the multitude of the saints gathered together as the encampment of Israel, going forth fighting the battles of Israel to establish the kingdom of Israel to the exclusion of all others, including the kingdom of Moab. Here was no curse. Here was a blessing. Let me die the death of the righteous. The word righteous means upright. It's the word yasher. Psalm 37 and verse 37 speaks of the end of the righteous being peace. That same word is used in the prophecy of Ezekiel in chapter 1 in a very interesting connection in view of what we've just been looking at, in that the strait is used of two of the aspects of the cherubim. The feet were spoken of as being straight, and there's another one in verses 7 and 23 in Ezekiel chapter 1. So, straight, upright, righteous is the characteristic of the saints. And the death of the righteous, that death is going to be reversed by resurrection, is it not? The death of the righteous. And let my last end be like his. We go to Daniel chapter 8 and verse 19. We see something of the latter day application of this prophecy. Daniel chapter 8 and verse 19. And he said, "Behold, I'll make thee know what shall be the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be." That word indignation is the word za'am, one of the words for curse, defy. At the last end of the defying. What's the context then of Daniel chapter 8? Now as he was speaking with me, verse 18, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, but he touched me and set me upright, so this is going to be fulfilled after the time of the resurrection. Behold, I will make thee know what shall be the last end, that same phrase as we've got in Numbers chapter 23, of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be the ram, the kings of Media and Persia, the rough goat, Grecia, verse 22, that being broken, four stood up for it. Verse 23, in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. The Roman power was going to come in the place of the Greeks. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy wonderfully and shall prosper and practice and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And indeed they have done. Through centuries, that power of Rome, it stood against the prince of the host in verse 11 and brought about his crucifixion. Through the centuries, it has destroyed the mighty and the holy people, both natural and spiritual Israel. Verse 25, and through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace or prosperity shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. He's going to stand up against Christ again. But he's going to be broken without hand. vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. Wherefore shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days. The latter day, little horn of the goat, is going to come against the people of Israel, and is going to stand against the prince of princes, and is going to be broken without hand. Let my last end be like his. This is no curse. This is a blessing. So Balak says to Balaam, what hast thou done to me? I took thee to curse mine enemies. Behold, thou hast blessed them altogether. And he answered and said, must I not take heed to speak that which Yahweh hath put in my mouth? I'm like the ass. I can only speak what God puts in my mouth. I have no words of my own. And Balak said unto him, come, I pray thee, with me unto another place. And so he tries again. And that's the subject of the next address. And let's just conclude by referring again to Micah chapter 6, because I think there's a great exhortation that we can take hold of here and take away with us for ourselves. All this was happening without Israel knowing. They may have known that Balaam was being hired to curse them out of the Pethor up in Aram, but surely they wouldn't know at the time what was happening. And as we've read in Deuteronomy, it was Yahweh that wrought their deliverance. Micah chapter 6 and verse 6. Wherewith shall I come before Yahweh and bow myself? And we've been through these chapters, these verses. What doth Yahweh require of thee? Verse 8. But to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy God. And that it comes after verse 5. O my people, remember now what Balak king of Moab consulted, and what Balaam the son of Beor answered him from Shittim unto Gilgal. The people of Israel were ignorant of what was happening upon the hill. They didn't know what they were being saved from. They may have felt that they wanted to murmur about the condition of the camp or something like that. They seem to be doing that all the time. They didn't know what they were being saved from. And what about us, brothers and sisters? The angels work in our lives to develop in us a character which is divine. And although we may have trouble from time to time, we don't know what we're being saved from. And Yahweh delivered them. Remember what Balak the king of Moab consulted, and what Balaam the son of Beor answered him from Shittim unto Gilgal. In spite of their sins, they were regarded as righteous, upright, in the mouth of the prophet Balaam, in the words of the Spirit. And they went from Shittim to Gilgal. They went across the river Jordan into the promised land. And the God that had delivered them from Egypt brought them into the land that was promised unto their fathers. And the same blessing will continue with us if only we will put our trust in our God. Remember what Balaam the son of Beor answered him from Shittim unto Gilgal, that ye may know the righteousness of Yahweh. It is not our own righteousness. It is an imputed righteousness. It is one that is developed in us by the hand of God working upon us. May it be, brothers and sisters, that we shall be amongst that community that will receive that same blessing, the end of the righteous, the last end like his, that we might know the righteousness of Yahweh.